Hi, my name is Zach Hershenson. I'm a personal injury attorney. I practice a law in Kent, Washington, which is a suburb of Seattle. I have an office here in Kent. We have another office in Ellensburg, Washington, which is east of the mountains. And then we have another office in Graham, Washington, which is in East Pierce County. And in all of those offices, we have a staff and our attorneys. And we represent individuals who are injured in those geographic areas. We exclusively practice personal injury law. And within that, we do many different kinds, but primarily car accident cases, car crash cases, trip and fall cases, Maritime Jones Act injury claims, FELA claims, and many other types of personal injury actions. I am here today to talk a little bit about our civil justice system. And what I mean by that is the system that we have in the United States, more specifically in Washington State, but it pretty much applies across the country for resolving civil disputes, as to be distinguished between civil and criminal disputes. So a criminal dispute is always between the state, either the federal entity and engaged enforcement, which is primarily the Department of Justice, or the state, meaning the local municipality, whether it's the state, it could be the Attorney General of Washington, or it could be any of the respective county district attorneys, so the DAs for the county. They can prosecute felonies, and then the local level, there are municipal prosecutors or district court prosecutors who could be prosecuting criminal cases. The civil justice system, as to be distinguished from the criminal system, is the system that we have in the United States and in Washington more specifically for adjudicating disputes between parties, meaning between either corporations and individuals, or individuals and other individuals. Or corporations and other corporations. And when I say corporations, of course, that means any of the various business entities that could exist where you've created a fictitious individual or, a judicially created individual. So those are the two broad different types of cases, criminal and civil cases. So what I'm here to do today is to discuss the difference between the two systems, and more specifically, what is the system that is in place for adjudicating civil disputes? And the reason I'm focused on that is because that is what personal injury law consists of. Personal injury law consists of the administ by me or the other attorneys that I work with, advocating on behalf of my clients through the civil justice system to get my clients as much money as possible. Okay. So what I'd like to do today is just give a very brief sort of introductory tutorial on what exactly the civil justice system is, how it works, and how, from a functional standpoint, it can be differentiated from the criminal justice system. And hopefully, if anyone actually listens to this, and would like to have some insight into how their case is going to proceed, they will be the beneficiary of understanding how the civil justice system works as it relates to their case. So let me start out with a sort of a brief sort of historical introduction to the civil justice system and how it exists for how it came to exist in the United States. So, and I'm taking some license with this because, of course, this is not a history course, but the situation is such with civil cases is that there have, over the years, as our economy has become more complicated, as the introduction of, say, mechanized transportation like cars buses, trains, things of that nature, also the Industrial Revolution. When these things happened, people were much more frequently interacting with other people in a context where there could be accidents or there could be injuries. The amount of commerce that people were engaged in, everyday people, as opposed to just sort of aristocrats and so forth, were engaged in, increased. So over the last 150 to 200 years, the opportunities for people to have disputes with other people, whether that's tort-based disputes where one person or one corporation or entity comes into contact with another individual and injures them in some way, or contractual disputes. People enter into business relationships with either other individuals or corporations, and then they have a dispute that arises over that that arrangement falling apart. They became much, much more likely than they had previous to this, right? So, you know, imagine a world where, you know, you don't have cars, you don't have trucks, you don't have mechanized equipment, you don't have planes, you have horses, you know, you have like people riding horses or in carriages, right? They're walking, you know, they're not even riding bicycles, right? So you don't even have bicycles. So in that world, there's just a much less frequent likelihood that you're going to be crashing into somebody else and being injured, right? And so when we're in law school, you know, when you're reading some of the early cases involving the development of tort law, you know, these are cases that were decided, you know, at the turn of the 19th century to the 20th century. And this really coincides with the, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, with all the changes that were taking place, because people were starting to come into contact with people much more frequently, you know, because the speed with which people were living their lives, the speed with which they were moving around physically was increased. And there was so a great deal much more interactions with other people in terms of physically interacting with them, and many more accidents, many more crashes, things crashing into each other, you know, trains crashing into humans, trains crashing into other humans, cars crashing into other cars, cars crashing into pedestrians. I mean, you know, bicycles crashing into other bicycles. All of these things were possible before you had cars, trains, cars, you know, trucks, things of that nature, all of these mechanized devices. And similarly, you know, prior to the development of industrial technologies, you didn't have nearly as many contractual relationships that developed. You didn't have as many disputes with people. If people had disputes from, you know, contractual disputes, it was usually, you know, people were wealthy aristocrats, so there was many fewer of these types of disputes. And so while there's always been criminal activity, there still remains criminal activity, and I'm not really sure if there's more. There probably is more criminal activity in relation to, maybe there is more criminal activity than there used to be. I'm not sure about that, right? Because, yeah, there's more commerce, but there may or may not be more criminal activity as it relates to the broader number of people. I know there was a book that was written a few years back by Steven Pinker called The Greater Angels of Our Nature, where he proposed that criminal conduct has decreased significantly over the millennia. But in terms of civil activity and the number of civil disputes, I can attest to that increasing in, roughly speaking, you know, around the turn of the 19th century all the way up to now, just increasing by several orders of magnitude. And so what occurred and what coincides with this, you know, significant increase in the number of civil disputes, tort and civil contract, although I think much more tort, is that the court system had to adjust itself, and the systems needed to adjust themselves to accommodate this. And so what we have developing is the development of civil rules of civil procedure. You know, I think independently of the federal government, and then ultimately the federal government itself became, was, you know, instituted sort of an approach that has now become the law, essentially the law of the land. And it comes in the form of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, the Federal Rules of Procedure are not what are explicitly used in Washington. In Washington, we don't use the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure themselves. We use the Washington court rules, but the Washington court rules are almost identical to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. They're not identical, but they're very, very similar. They essentially use the same basic structure to them, and they certainly have the same objectives. They work in the same way. So there are some states, I think it's about 35 of the states that are like Washington, which have explicitly are explicitly just counterparts or they're facsimiles of the civil rules, Federal Rules of Procedure. But Washington is very close to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. All the in terms of the actual nomenclature of the rules, meaning the numbers that are used respectively for different types of civil procedures are the same in Washington as they are in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So, for example, the rule concerning depositions in Washington State is Civil Rule 30. And under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, it's also Civil Rule 30, and so forth, right? So there are some rules that are a little different, like Federal Civil Procedure number 21 is different. So it's like lay down discovery. There's some differences, and so they don't always line up exactly the same, but the general structure is the same, a lot of the pleading rules, at least in Washington and in Federal Rules of Procedure, are the same. It's notice pleading state. So there's a lot of this is a state that's very close to the Federal Rules of Procedure. The one state that I'm most familiar with, it's in terms of states that are not following the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, is Oregon. Oregon is completely out of whack. It's just like out on its own, doing its own thing. They don't follow the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. They don't have the same types of processes at all. And so that's like an outlier. I've heard, although I'm not 100% sure about this, that Louisiana has some pretty significant differences. And I would say even California has some, a state where I'm not licensed, but I do have some familiarity, has also some pretty significant differences. So let's talk a little bit about what it is that differentiates the civil justice system. What are the objectives of the civil justice system in relative terms to the criminal system? So, and I'm speaking in broad generalities here, but the civil justice system, the system that I operate in, is set up in a way so that to promote the resolution of claims explicitly. Right. And so the way that the civil justice system works and the way that it accomplishes that objective is that it permits the attorneys, the respective attorneys and the respective parties in the case to develop all the evidence that's going to be presented at a trial before the trial occurs. Essentially, what it does is the civil justice system takes a trial. It's a decent sized civil trial. It would take 2 weeks, for example, to put on all of the evidence that you're going to put on. Say it'd take 2 weeks, put it on, meaning you'd call the witnesses to the bench, you'd take their testimony, And you know, and that's it, right? You take all their testimony. It's primarily testimony. Say you could have some process for exchanging documents, for example, but you know, just take a trial, okay? And then you say all the constituent parts of a trial. What the civil justice system does is it unpacks that and allows all of that stuff that would happen at trial to happen outside of the court, usually in an attorney's office, right? Usually in the form of a deposition, and allows it to occur without the trial actually happening. So there are really, I would say three primary ways that evidence is developed prior to trial. Interrogatories, so that's the exchange of written questions and answers that are given under oath to respective parties. You have requests for production, so those are written instruments that are served out on the, can be served out by a plaintiff, can be served out by the defendant, on the plaintiff or vice versa, and those are demands and commands to produce documents that are in the possession or control of the respective parties. And then the big one is depositions, right? So a deposition is when it comes to a party, it can be compelled by simple notice to the plaintiff or the defendant. And a deposition is also the methodology for getting the production of documents from third parties under Civil Rule 45. And that's the same in the federal court system. So Washington Civil Rule 45, same under the federal system. And that's how you get all of the evidence developed. So that really constitutes the spectrum of what's useful in terms of developing the evidence. And the big one, of course, is depositions, right? And so a deposition is an out-of-court process that occurs in the course of the discovery process in advance of an actual trial date. And it is the opportunity to take testimony from relevant witnesses in the case. Oftentimes it's the plaintiff or the defendant, but it can be any of the witnesses in the case. And when they give that testimony, they give the testimony under oath, and it's a live question and answer type of a testimony that's taken in the presence of a certified court reporter who creates a transcript. That transcript then is sworn testimony given under oath. So if the case actually was to go to trial, the deposition is really since it's a sworn statement given under oath, the plaintiff or the defendant or the witness, if it's a witness, percipient witness in the case, they are bound to that testimony. So let me just explain how that works. Imagine for a moment that you've given testimony under oath in a deposition. It's written down. You've sworn, right? And say you said in your deposition that the light was green when you drove through it. Then you get to trial and you've got a sworn statement where you said the light was green. You try to change your testimony at trial. You can't do it, right? And so a deposition is a way to get the respective parties and any important witnesses locked in so that you have that testimonial evidence in the can, so to speak, and it can't be changed in the future. And so what that does, and you know what that process does, along with the production of interrogatory responses and the production of documents, what that does is that if you could imagine that a trial is actually the presentation of sworn testimony, that's what a trial is. Trial is sworn testimony, and then the lawyer saying a bunch of things about the sworn testimony, essentially making comments about what the sworn testimony means, right, in front of a jury. That's a trial, along with legal arguments and so forth. So that's a trial. So if you have actually all of the deposition, if you have all the testimony that's going to be presented at a trial already elicited from the witnesses, then the attorneys, the insurance carriers, the parties, everybody can sit down, read through that testimony, and they can know with reasonable certainty what evidence is going to be presented on either side. Now, they don't, now, mind you, the defendants, the insurance carriers, the plaintiffs, the attorneys for both the plaintiffs and the defendants, they don't know what a jury is going to do. They don't know what a judge is going to do. Judges could do whatever they want. There's all kinds of things judges do all the time that, you know, surprise people. There's all kinds of things that juries do all the time that surprise people. But once you've elicited the evidence from the witnesses that are going to give testimony at the trial, you know at least what the evidence is going to be for the most part. You don't know how those, how that evidence is going to intersect with juries or judges. And so that's a question. And sometimes there's some legal issues that hang on top of things. But that's the way the system is set up, right? And that's the way that the federal rules of civil procedure, which is what the, you know, which is what is the underlying structural and procedural basis for Washington civil rules, it's set up in the same way. And they know that the people who divide those rules, the people who develop those rules, did it deliberately, because there are so many civil cases that are filed, so many civil cases that need to be adjudicated in a given year in any major metropolitan area in the United States, King County and Pierce County being no exceptions. I just looked online today, and this was an annual report from 2022, and right as this happened in 2022, so the numbers are probably slightly different now. But in terms of civil cases that were filed, there was at that point 49,593 cases that were filed. These are civil matters. I read some point there was something like, I don't know, 300 or something like that, civil trials in King County. Oh, no, here you go. Yeah, all right. So here you go. So this is the trial. So I'm wrong. It says the trial, the court had fewer trials in 2022 than in 2021, totaling 818 trials. So this is two, and it says 224 jury trials. Well, so 224 jury trials. You can be rest assured that the 224 jury trials were, that anybody taking a personal injury case to trial is going to be a jury trial. So I don't think it's completely inaccurate. And we don't know how many of those 48,000 some cases were car crash cases, or, you know, I'm sure there's some way to divine that from the statistics here. But the point is that when you're talking about civil justice, you're talking about a number of cases that could never, ever be efficiently adjudicated by actually taking the cases to trial. The system is set up to settle the case. And that's to be differentiated from the criminal procedures, right? So criminal procedures, I mean, they resolve many of the, most of the cases, I think, and I'm not being super familiar with the criminal matters, but they do resolve most of the cases without trials. And they, you know, they get a lot of plea agreements from the defendants. But they don't have the same system in place that we do, which is specifically designed to prompt settlement. In other words, they can't develop all the evidence that's going to be presented at a criminal trial in a pre-trial proceeding, which is what the civil justice system is. So what ends up happening is that, you know, you go through the process, essentially put the trial on that you're going to put on during the course of the discovery process. So the discovery process through the form of deposition testimony, that is effectively the trial. The only part that doesn't happen in terms of the trial is the presenting of that evidence to the jury, meaning putting the selected portions of the deposition in front of the jury, meaning I would take direct testimony from my plaintiff. The defendant would have an opportunity to cross-examine the plaintiff. And so it's a sort of a snapshot of the evidence that's developed from the discovery depositions. And then the jury gets to hear that evidence, and then the lawyers get to make comment on the testimony that's given in relation to the jury instructions that they get and the verdict form that they get, and the jury gets to make this determination. And so to differentiate that from the criminal case, they're presenting all of that evidence at trial. So there's a much greater likelihood of surprise. There's a much more unknown. And the point of the criminal process itself is not, the procedure itself is not designed to foster settlement of the claims. That is the explicit purpose of the way in which the civil justice system is arranged. And so what I would like to do is just to talk briefly in closing about what are the factors, given that that is the structure of the civil justice system, what are the factors that make a trial likely, unlikely, right? For example, in your case, what if you were, what if you had a car crash case or a slip and fall case or maritime injury claim and I was representing you? We can assume that since there are many, many of our cases that are never even going into litigation, but let's assume that the case is in litigation. What are the factors that go into whether a case is actually going to go to trial, right? Let me just give you some context here, because I did look up some of these statistics that I was actually almost surprised by. I looked up, this was a very particularly interesting one. This is for March 2024. And this is the title is, this is at courts.washington.gov/caseload. And this is the caseloads of the courts of Washington State. It has every single county in Washington State. And this is the civil proceedings. And this is all the trials that have been continued, canceled, or stricken in March of 2024. So this was last month. And as I go down the list here, right? So the number of cases that were stricken, continued, canceled. These are trials that got struck. It's 741. Right, that's a whole lot. And then I looked up here trials by types of cases for the same period of time. And when you go to tort cases, right? So the tort cases, and this was in March of 2024, right? And the number of tort cases in the entire state, number of tort cases that went to trial in that whole month were five. So there's 750 cases that were continued, stricken, canceled, et cetera, and five went to trial. And that's for the entire state of Washington. So, what you can kind of divine from that is, hey, these things don't happen very often. And that's all the lawyers in Washington State who do tort law trying to get these cases to trial. So start out, is it likely your case is going to trial? I mean, on general principles, it's pretty unlikely, right? Like, that's just a snapshot of one month. And we talked a little bit about the number of cases that are out there that are actually filed. Something in the order of 50,000 actively cases that are being litigated. Now, we don't know exactly precisely how many of those are tort claims, how many are civil disputes that have to do with contracts. But, I mean, there's a ton of cases out there. And when we just looked even in the month of March, we can see that, like, essentially everything that was going to go to trial except for five cases got continued, right? We're expected to go to trial in about a week. That case was continued twice before it went. So it's going to go. It's actually going to go out. I do everything in my power. I don't do anything to try to avoid trials, right? If the case client wants to go to trial, I'm like, hey, let's do it, right? And I go to trial probably more than, I would say, 95% of personal injury lawyers in Washington State. And I usually try like two cases a year if I'm lucky. Right, it just doesn't happen that often, and that's because the system is literally set up to settle cases, right? And you take a position in a case, you say I want to try. So all that's to say, it's not likely that cases go to trial anyway. But I want to just briefly close with some of the factors that make trial slash likely or unlikely. Okay. Well, all right. So let's start out with the biggest one, right? So insurance. Okay. So this is a little, obviously, if you go to trial, the jury never gets to hear about insurance. But does insurance make a big difference? Absolutely. Right. Why is that? Well, if you've got a policy, you've got an insurance policy that you're trying to get, and the insurance policy is small enough so that the insurance company eventually just says, here's the policy, or where the insurance company feels that there's a bona fide threat that your verdict could exceed the policy, they're either going to make a really, really good effort to try and settle the claim for a number that's maybe just below the policy limits, or they're just going to turn over the policy limits, right? So that's a big factor. So, you know, the factors that go into there being a high likelihood of an actual trial is the circumstances where you have either an enormous policy, right? So, you know, anywhere, I would say enormous policy has got to be a $5 million policy. But if you had a case where you have like $300,000 to $600,000 in kind of exposure for the defendant, if you got $1 million in coverage, that's a good amount of coverage, right? So that would make it more likely. If you have an ample amount of coverage for the nature of the claim, that's a big factor. Right, there's no danger of the actual party in the case actually being exposed to a judgment. There's no risk, for example, on the side of the insurance company that the insurance company is going to be exposed to exemplary damages as a consequence of the verdict and judgment. That makes the trial more likely because the jury, the insurance company is not taking a risk by going to trial that they're going to have to pay in an excess. And the party, to the extent that the party is concerned about it, they're not exposed personally, so they don't have a dog in that fight. That makes trial more likely. Okay, so that's one factor. The other factor is, what are the damages, right? So let's just say, for example, you've got a case with enormous damages, right? Even if those damages are disputed, right? And it's often the case that where you have a dispute over damages, that you're going to have a more likely situation where a trial could occur, right? So if you've got a situation where you, as the plaintiff, think that the case is worth, from a damages standpoint, is worth, $4 million, and the defendants think the case is worth zero or $20,000 from a damages case, that's a huge, big factor for making the case more likely to go to trial. And I'd say almost without saying things that are too categorical, that would be probably one of the most important factors. The other factor would be a big dispute over the facts of the accident or a medical dispute of some sort. And the medical dispute is really where that's kind of where the big dispute over the amount of damages comes about. Where you have injuries where the person is manifest damages where it's difficult to explicitly document or prove the damages. You know, brain injuries is sort of the quintessential one. But you can have other medical situations where there's a little bit more complexity to the medical aspect of the case. So there's a dispute that arises where the plaintiff says, well, this case is worth X amount, and the defendants say, well, it's worth this Y amount, and the Y amount is orders of magnitude lower than the amount that the plaintiff believes. That's an asymmetry that's going to have a much more likelihood of going to trial. Same on the facts of the accident, right? If you got a situation where the plaintiff looks at the facts of the accident, thinks that this is a liability case, the defendant looks at the case and thinks it's not a liability case, or thinks there's a good chance they could get out of the case by taking it to trial, that's a much more likely case that goes to trial, right? And again, like where you have a dispute over the amount of the damages, you could have a situation where somebody thinks that where there's some kind of dispute over how to interpret how the damages are going to be applied, right? And there's a big damage that can be expressed. Something like you can have something like a dispute over a partial wage. Accident, but you're in a dispute over what the injuries mean in terms of wage loss, and you have a big discrepancy there. That's a situation where you have a tendency to go to trial. But and so the as a broad proposition, you can just know if it's your case that look, it's very unlikely that the case goes to trial. That's not Zach's fault. That's not Zach's. Zach didn't cause that. That's the federal civil procedure as interpreted and applied and instantiated as the Washington rules of civil procedure, which are the same. And the way that the system's set up, right? And we can see that that's just the way it is, right? So the cases that do go to trial, and this is borne out certainly with the last 4 or 5 years from my perspective as to what cases go to trial, it is broadly speaking defined by the nature of the dispute and the variance between the two parties in terms of the valuation that is based upon that dispute. And that could be, like I said, over the medical care, the facts of the accident, the amount of damages, and all of it tempered by the fact that if there isn't any money to be had, then it's unlikely that there's going to be a trial. There's just going to be a resolution before trial. So in closing, those are the factors that go into, whether or not there's a trial, and, my description of the civil justice system, I think is probably at least helpful in understanding how you arrive at that inflection point of whether or not you're going to go to trial. Here at Hershenson Law, we fight all the way to the end, not in every single case, because a lot of times we can get an adjudication or a settlement without having to go to trial, as we've discussed. But every single person who gets represented by this office has the opportunity, if they really, really desire to do so and the facts support it, to take their case and go to trial. But as I said, even if you try really, really hard to go to trial, it's not easy to get there. So thanks so much for listening. Take care. Have a great day.